How do you grow like a VC-backed company without taking on investors? Do you want to create a lifestyle business, a performance business, or an empire? How do you scale to an exit without losing your freedom? Those are the questions, and this show is the answer. I have Alex Levin. Alex is the co-founder and CEO of Regal.io. Prior to Regal, Alex was a product manager at Thomson Reuters, then joined Handy, which was acquired by Angi very early on. He led growth and marketing over there and is doing some really cool things in customization of B2C sales space. Alex, welcome. Happy to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know why your intro was so hard for me to do with the Handy and the Angi. I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know what my problem is. So anyways, before we get too deep in your story, let's do a real quick revenue rundown to understand kind of like where you're at in terms of the stage of the journey with your organization. So in terms of that, what revenue stage are you guys at right now?
Yeah, I think they call us these days like a scale up. Maybe, you know, we have a couple hundred customers. You know, we've raised quite a bit of money from venture capital and, you know, have been growing quite quickly. I think at this point, you know, the challenges are like, how do you continue to scale up the go-to-market team to meet the demand that exists?
Yeah, true, man. Very true. So what series are you guys then in terms of the raise level? Are you A, B, C?
Yeah, I don't think we've sort of disclosed all of our fundraising, but yeah, we've raised more than $50 million. So okay. Quite a bit of money.
Yeah. So you got quite, so you're definitely in that stage. So what's your primary go-to-market in terms of customer acquisition and revenue growth?
As a company, you know, we sell into contact centers and it's a traditionally sort of slower sales cycle, if you will. And you know, what works well for us is we have a lot of organic sort of referral type, you know, sourcing because, you know, people use us, like us, and then recommend us. We see quite a bit of success in conferences. Like that's a good way for us to meet customers, build trust. Definitely we have an outbound BDR motion that works well. We in contact center, there traditionally is a very big partner channel where you go through sort of established partners in the space. And so that works for us as well. And then, you know, I'd say, you know, it can take anywhere from, you know, 15 days to 2 years in contact center to close like a customer, you know, it can take a long time.
Okay. So a wide ranging sales cycle, if you will, 15 days to 2 years is quite an expansive number. So how large is your team right now, Alex?
We have a little more than 100 people.
Okay, cool. And then can you walk us through exactly what Regal does just so everybody has a context of it? Maybe give us a 2 to 3 sentence description of it.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're in a contact center environment today, this will all make more sense. But, you know, what happens often is in more considered industries like healthcare or education or local services, you know that you need to engage the customer, have a conversation with them. So what you do is, you know, you might find somebody who's looking to come to your school and call them. And the traditional technology results in very low answer rates, low customer engagement. And so what we're doing is helping these businesses understand which customers they should reach out to, when, and in what channel to drive up answer rates, up conversion rates, up the revenue that they're generating from these leads. It's very different than a B2B motion, right? Because B2B, it's like a $50,000 sale or something, and you have a very expensive salesperson that does it. In the industries we work in, you know, it might be a $500 sale and you have to have a much higher velocity, much more efficient motion to be able to, you know, have a sales team that's going after that. And, you know, when we're working with our customers, I'd say their sort of ask tends to split into one of three things. Like either they really want to increase their connect rate, like find a way to get more people on the phone, or B, like increased conversion rate because they're connecting with them, but they are not converting enough. Or C, like have a better infrastructure for A-B testing and iterating and trying new things. So sometimes it's all three, but often it falls into one of them. And so as a product, you know, we come in and we become the contact center software for those teams, right? It's the way they're engaging with customers on phone, SMS, voice, but we layer on something that doesn't exist traditionally in contact centers, which is what I sometimes call marketing automation. So the ability to use real-time customer data to orchestrate how you're reaching customers in different situations.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's funny because like, if you look at most of like the product-led growth approaches, those are for lower dollar value sales, but I don't see it very often applied for the sales side, right? So I assume you're cooking with gas. Has the market been like hyper responsive to it, or is it a lot of educating to bring them up to speed on what's involved with that and then training other teams, or what's kind of the response to, that you're receiving on that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Regal is one of the faster growing companies, you know, in this space. I think we went from 0 to $1 million in AR in 6 months. Then we hit $3 million in the first year, $9 million by the end of the second year. So, you know, there's a business here. I think, you know, the larger the customer in contact centers, the slower moving they are, you know, because they have hundreds and hundreds of, or thousands and thousands of agents in a contact center tool. So if they're changing, it's not just changing the software, but changing the workflow of all of those agents. So there's a, you know, certainly like as we move into more enterprise level customers, the deal cycles do slow down. But, you know, I think it's, yeah, it's been sort of very good response so far.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you hit 9 million, you say 9 million at the end of year two, or was that the end of year three?
Two.
That's amazing, man. So like, let's dig into that. And then I want to dig in the agent aspect a little bit deeper. So what led to that success? And like, how did you scale so fast from 0 to 9 in 2 years? Because I think that's amazing, man.
Yeah, I think like, you know, some of it certainly is weird luck. Like, you know, we were, you know, we understood the challenges that were happening and at the right time had products that would help our, you know, this type of customer drive better outcomes. But, you know, in terms of the things that we had control over, you know, the first 3 million, like I sold myself, like there was no sales team, like it was just me. And so I think using founder-led sales for a while really does have an impact, making sure that you're sort of really understanding what the need is. And then, you know, as we sort of built out a sales team, we brought on sort of folks that were able to build out what was initially, I say, a relatively middle market motion. And we've since now started to move up market in a more sophisticated motion. But, you know, understanding, like having, you know, run contact centers, understanding the pain point, really making sure we were linked to a revenue number as we were selling the product was part of what made it, you know, quick to sell.
Yeah, I think, I mean, 3 million by yourself, I think that's fantastic, you know, that you did that as a founder. And I mean, like, are we talking, if we're talking deal sizes, like what's the range of that someone would pay you guys to do that? You know, and I don't want you to
at the beginning, an average deal was probably like 50K. Now it's closer to like 100K on average. And, you know, the newer deals are probably 500K to a million, stuff like
that. Okay. That's fantastic, man. And then how did you make it so sticky then in terms of your approach, like from a product design perspective?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, again, we are in a category that is traditionally sticky. So something like 60% of contact center seats are still on-prem. They haven't even moved to the cloud. So, you know, once you have somebody using your software, they shouldn't switch. I think, you know, what we try to do, particularly in our world, is make sure that our customers are getting a lot of value from the product, right? Driving a lot of incremental revenue from it, which makes it harder for them to want to go somewhere else. And, you know, we do have a very differentiated feature set around this outbound journey builder. And so if people are getting revenue from that product specifically, they can't go somewhere else to get it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I assume there's a lot of upskilling that needs to happen. Are most of the contact centers, are those offshore, or are those in the US that your clients have, or what does it kind of look like?
Yeah, so there's about 16 million contact center seats, you know, around. We focus on the few million that are outbound. While sort of the majority of contact center seats are abroad, the outbound ones tend to be in the US because for something like sales, you know, you tend to want to have a native speaker, somebody who's a bit closer to your customer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's shift gears a little bit. You mentioned agents in terms of like, obviously the agents operating in the contact centers. What do you think about AI agents and the potential of them taking over the contact center role specifically for outbound?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not the thing that's going to happen first because it's a more complicated conversation. Like I said, it's part of why, like, you know, it's been more US agents rather than abroad. But, you know, it'll happen eventually. I think the question is just how quickly and in what order. So, you know, right now there's a huge amount of investment going into like, how do you automate a lot of the interactions for support? But they're on SMS, you know, on text or on voice. We see that eventually coming for, you know, outbound as well. So, you know, we've started investing in how to do that for our clients. I'd say the state of things is it's improving quickly, but it's not there yet. Like, there are still enough issues with like talking with a voice bot, particularly, that it's not quite good enough. But, you know, give it 2 or 3 years, it'll probably be there. And then, like, you know, the roles within a contact center will shift drastically. Like, there won't be as many agents. Like, there'll be more people doing escalations and handling exceptions and managing the bot, but fewer agents actually on the phone. The one sort of unknown in all this, if you will, is like, how is the customer going to react to talking to AI? Even if it is indistinguishable from a human, brands are going to be required to tell a customer that they're talking with AI. So you'll know that it's AI. Will you value the brand more if they put a real human being on the phone as opposed to a bot? Or like, do you not care as a customer because a bot will be constantly available and so like you won't have to wait for them ever? I don't know. Unclear like how customers are going to ultimately react.
What do you think, Matt? I mean, you're pretty progressive in terms of how you're looking at it. Like, because that is, you know, that's kind of the, I think because of what happened with the robocalls with Biden, wasn't it? In like the Northeast where they basically, they used his voice and then they had him.
Yeah, that was like very sort of basic recorded stuff. But yeah, I think like this is what's hard to, you know, I don't know, what's an example? Like you can go and watch Hamilton on your iPad. And some people prefer that. But, you know, people are still paying quite a bit of money to go in person and see Hamilton live and see with the original cast. Like, is there any, you know, is there any actual difference between seeing it on the screen and in person? We're seeing the same thing, but people value the in-person one more and are willing to pay 10x the price probably for that right. So, you know, as you think about like how brands are going to decide to interact with customers, I think you'll see something similar, which is that there'll be better and better sort of bots that allow sort of first level support, but you're still going to want to differentiate for the best customers. You know, I think there may be a turning point one day where the bot is actually better than the human. And so like, then the like rich will want, you know, the highest quality customers will want the bot, not the human, but we're not there yet. Like, I don't think we're quite in that place.
I love that example of Hamilton live versus like on your iPad or Netflix. I think that's, well, not Netflix, but streaming, if you will. Right. So like, I think that's a good concept and that makes a lot of sense with, it's a good descriptor, right? Because that is very true. And you're right.
Yeah. Probably, I'll give like a silly, you know, silly example, like growing up, I banked with a little bank nearby, like M&T Bank or whatever. And there was Bob the banker. And like, you know, if you made a mistake, it's not like I pulled the money out. I stayed with M&T Bank and there was Bob. And that was a person with a life and a family and kids and whatever. When you go to Varo or Chime to pick on the online providers, like there is no relationship. If they make a mistake, you're leaving immediately and going somewhere else. And so, you know, even if Varo or Chime had a bot, would I feel the same emotional attachment to that bot that I felt to Bob? Probably not, because the bots don't have children, as far as I know. So, you know, I think, you know, there's going to be an interesting sort of comparison. Like the cost of humans will likely be higher, not as much higher as people imagine, because there is a real cost to AI, but it will be higher of humans, but maybe customers will react better to it.
Hello, this is Ryan here. Real quick, if you are enjoying this episode, please hit the subscribe button and leave a comment or review. If you want more help or just want to learn more about what the top SaaS CEOs and founders are doing, check out my website at www.ryanstaley.io. Join my newsletter, check out other free content resources I have there, and let me know if you want to scale your business. Now back to the episode. So let's get into kind of like about how customers or why you should really have conversations with your customers. And I know you feel strongly about that. Walk us through what you're thinking with that. And, you know, I mean, it's a good segue jumping from AI and have the automated bot to actually talking to them live. So
whether it's a bot or a human, like what we've learned is that there are certain types of products and services where you have to build trust with the customer. And just having a website that they view on their mobile device is not building enough trust. And so if, you know, if you take banking as an example, when people used to physically walk into a branch and talk to somebody, they'd fund the account 90% of the time. When someone opens an account online, they only fund the account 20 or 30% of the time. So the internet is increasing the distribution of that platform, but there's not enough trust for somebody to actually give them money. So again, whether you use a bot or a human, actually engaging with that person and saying, hey, you're going to open a bank account. It's important. Maybe you didn't get all the information you need looking on that little screen on your mobile device. Like, what is it you're wondering about? And somebody going, well, you know, am I really going to be charged $10 a month? Or is, you know, is the US government going to steal my money if I put it in it? Or what's the FDIC? You know, all these things may in theory be on your, you know, support page somewhere, but people aren't getting the knowledge they need to go make a decision. So having that touch point is, you know, should be seen as an extension of the experience of the brand rather than as something very different. So, you know, we work with SoFi, for instance, who does student loan refinance. You know, one of the things they do if you get stuck in your flow is they'll call you. And part of our value proposition is the calls are branded and they say SoFi on them. So it's not an interruption. It's thank goodness there's somebody from SoFi who's going to help me figure out my student loan because this is complicated. And so brands that see that personal interaction is yet just another touch point, an important touch point that's part of the cohesive experience with a customer are going to succeed, right? Brands that don't are going to go by the wayside because, like, look at financial services. Like, the infrastructure has now become commoditized. A lot of the technology is commoditized. You know, maybe you have a differentiated brand, but that's not that different. Like, service is a place you really can differentiate and make sure that a customer chooses you rather than somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how do you, I think that makes a lot of sense. And there's some examples I could give specifically that I'm seeing right now. But like, so how do you implement that with your own team and within your motions in terms of working with clients? Like, is there a special formula that you leverage for that?
Within Regal's like B2B motion,
yeah.
You mean?
Yeah.
I mean, at a high level, like culturally, like one of the values of the company is that customers are royalty and like we do really value, you know, that relationship. And we make sure that we're prioritizing the goals of our customers, like them driving better outcomes for their, you know, customers, whether it's healthcare or something else. So I think that's a big part of it. In terms of like the iteration and the testing, like I will say one of the challenges with B2B is that you don't have as much data or as much volume. And so it's much harder to do this kind of iterative testing because you only have 10 customers. Whereas in, you know, at Angie, when we were there, we had a million customers a week. And so you could do all kinds of A/B testing. So it can be harder in B2B to do some of this, but the principles are the same, right? You know, if you know that there's somebody who comes from a certain industry and they're looking at, you know, certain things that you've reported on, you know, don't send them the email about whatever, you know, automotive, whatever, like focus on who that user is and how you're going to get them the right content in the right place. What I ask people to imagine often is, you know, imagine like my wife's friend who runs a little business where she's an Allstate agent. You know, she in her town knows everybody and she knows everything about them and their kids and their pets and their whatever. And the reason she does so well is because when somebody walks in, she really cares about them and she knows she can use the information she has to get them the right product. Online, you know, whether it's B2B or B2C, a lot of that's been lost. And so if we can get back to a world where we care about making sure we have the first party data about the customer, I'm not saying steal their data. I'm saying use what you know about them to make sure that you're engaging them in the right way. That goes a long, long way with people.
So you think, do you think a lot of SaaS companies just miss the mark on that right now?
Like I said, like I think there's less data in B2B or SaaS, so it's harder. But broadly, like, yeah, I would say, you know, a lot of SaaS companies aren't spending the time thinking about like how to do this. There are some great products in the marketplace that can help. So like Mutiny is a product that helps personalize your websites, or, you know, certainly like you can use a lot of AI products to personalize your outreach, or, you know, there's a lot of automation you can do using like a Braze or an Iterable or, you know, demand base or something that's more of a B2B tool to change how like the emails, you know, go out to different people. So you can do it. But yeah, it's definitely not the MO in B2B.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, like, so what I was mentioning when I said, like, I got an example is like, they actually did a study because there's so many Zoom meetings, so many video meetings. And like, if you actually do live meetings, I think it's like, there's a 70% uplift in like the stimulation in your brain that happens if you're meeting with someone live versus virtually. Which, you know, it's funny because, and I saw this too, even with after the pandemic, people were still just relying on web for everything. They weren't actually like physically meeting or seeing people in person. And it was like, I know this sounds weird, but like the number one best hack for getting big deals done was literally just meeting with them in person and like connecting with them as humans again. Right. So I see that happening still, even though we're years and years later. So, so let's go back to your original journey of like when you were founder led sales and that was your core focus and you were building the company from, you know, zero to something very impressive. Like, what advice would you give to other founders that are going through the same stage right now in terms of like how to manage everything from product to prospecting to customer acquisition to operations to finance? Like, how did you manage it all on a day-to-day basis? And then like, what would be your framework for recreating it again now that you know what you know after going through that?
Yeah, I, you know, I wouldn't say I have all the answers, but you know, I'll highlight a couple of the problems and how we think about them. So, you know, one of the big problems is just how much there is to do. Like as a founder, there's a million things you need to be doing. And basically my answer is like, you can't do it alone. Like you need to have a co-founder, you need to have somebody you trust, and not just like somebody you trust, but somebody who can take significant amounts of the things that need to be done and own them. So like I'm lucky, I have a co-founder where, you know, she runs part of the business and I run part of the business and we can run very independently and not have to look over each other's shoulders. I don't know how I would do it if it were not that kind of setup. So, you know, you're not going to find that person on Reddit. Like you're going to build relationships with a real human being over time and hopefully find complementary skill sets so you can start a business together. And it doesn't have to be, I think the default is like, oh, one person, a business person, another person, an engineer. Not necessarily. I'm just saying they have to be two different areas so you guys can at least knock some stuff out without engaging with each other. I'd say another, you know, big challenge with these businesses as they grow is how do you move from a world where you, you know, you as a founder are the only ones in the business and you can create all the urgency in the world to now you have a bigger team and like, how do you create that accountability and urgency across the team? You know, and if you like read the biography of Elon Musk or something like that, you know, he's insane. Like he like, you know, wants to like have everybody sleep on the floor of the, you know, of the office or the factory until the thing is done. Or if you hear about Facebook in early days, when they had a project that they needed urgently done, literally Zuckerberg would say, okay, campus is shut down. You can't leave. You have to work on this. And like, if your families want to see you, they got to come here. Okay. I'm not saying you have to go all the way to that level of urgency, but you have to have some way of, you know, making a wider group of people believe that, you know, this is something important. And the reason is this, like, if every day you're coming in and solving hard problems and serving more of them, like your company is moving forward. If you're either not solving hard problems, so like it was easy today at work, or you're not solving them fast enough, that's giving room for somebody else to catch up. And in a startup, the single advantage you have is that you can work faster than other people and more efficiently than other people, right? You have disadvantages in every other area. So, you know, you need to find a way to create that urgency, whether it's through how you hire, how you motivate people, how you compensate them, how you communicate, like that's critical. And then I'd say like, you know, the other piece is, I think a lot of people are too hesitant around, you know, what they think they need to have done to take it to a customer. Like the famous line is like, you should be embarrassed when you show a product to a customer. It's true. Like if you're waiting until you've built the perfect thing to take it to a customer, one, you've built it wrong. I can just guarantee you. And two, like by the time you build it, like the customer is going to have other needs. So instead, like figuring out how you understand the customer's needs and build the smallest piece of that you can. Maybe it's even not even an engineering thing. It might be a hack together thing, or it might be a, you know, screenshot that you put in a deck in order to get their feedback and start understanding and then get them using a little bit of it, see some, you know, ROI, like that's critical. And so I think companies that succeed are the ones that figure out that loop. And actually the way I often put it is that they fail fast and they fail a lot. And people are surprised by that. Like, why would a successful company fail? Well, actually, like the successful companies are the ones that set it up so they can constantly be failing on small things and iterating and moving forward. The unsuccessful companies are the ones that are so hesitant to try anything and fail that they make big movements. Well, either they make no movement and they die, or they make big movements, they're wrong, and then they die. So you don't want to be the one that fails a few times. You want to be the one that fails small a lot.
Yeah, I like it, man. No, it definitely resonates. I just heard another founder talking about it, and he's like, effectively, like with your product, like you want to invest like 100 hours, 10 hours for 10 different tests, if possible, right? In terms of iterating and trying what it is until you find what really works, right? And that time isn't wasted time. That's invested time in understanding what the right way is, right? So, yeah, I really like that. I think that's some sage advice. I think that's really strong. Unfortunately, we're up on time. So where can people find you? Where can they find out more about Regal? And then we'll wrap things up, man.
Sure. So find out more about Regal at regal.io. And you can always email me at hello@regal.io.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being on, Alex. This was great. Went by really quick, covered a lot of ground fast, and appreciate you being on the show, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for checking out the Scale Up Show. My mission in life is to help founders and revenue leaders avoid all the pain and suffering in revenue growth so they can flip it and create a life of their own design. So if you enjoyed this show, please like, review, share it on social, and more importantly, just share it with a friend. Share it with someone that you think could learn and benefit from what you heard on today. But the more we get the message out, the more people we could help, the bigger the impact we make, and the bigger the community gets, which helps everybody. So once again, thank you for being a loyal listener. I appreciate you and look forward to seeing you on the next episode.